Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As we revealed last week, our man on the inside says all a terrorist has to do if they want to get into the Olympics is just queue up. Meanwhile, Channel 4 News' Simon Israel transmitted a report on Monday this week saying all is well. The only thing to worry about is peaceful protester Simon Moore. Well, I'm joined on the line again this week by Lee Hazeldean, who's working undercover as a security guard. Working as a security guard, training with G4S for the up-and-coming London Olympics. Well, hi, Lee, and welcome again to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me back.
Okay, first question this week is, how's it going? Are you still managing to maintain your cover? Has anyone rumbled you yet?
At the moment, everything's all is well. However, I did hear from a colleague who spoke to G4S yesterday that they were apoplectic about the fact that a journalist had actually snuck onto the course and was revealing their innermost secrets.
See, this is one of the things we didn't really talk about last week, isn't it? Is that actually, in a way, you have proven that there's something wrong if they can't filter you out. And, you know, you gave your journalistic credentials as part of your references, and they still didn't figure out that you were up to what you were doing, which is essentially infiltrating them.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the thing is they're not doing their job properly on any level. They had their contract was $86 million to begin with, and they've upped it to $284 million, and that's taxpayers' money paying for this. And they're not doing a good enough job. So from checking references, which is the first thing you should be doing when an application's made, they're not doing that properly. They're not training people properly. And then from those security officers who aren't trained properly, they'll be then onto the Olympics, when there's going to be so many problems with people coming, not speaking the right languages, being treated badly. It's on every level. It's endemic, in fact.
One of the things you said last week, which disturbed me particularly, was this whole idea of G4S actually being a kind of private military company in the guise of a security firm. And you talked about them using terms like major and this kind of thing within their ranks. Now, is that, do you think they're referring to people who are senior in G4S who were ex-military, or do they actually quite like using those terms?
As far as I can see, that's business as usual. They like using those terms. I think what happens is that if you're a soldier in the British Army, say you're a paratrooper in 2 Power or something, your contract with the British military ends and you sign straight over to be an officer with G4S. You keep your rank. You're there at the same rank as you were, and that's what people refer to each other as. We're forever getting people putting their rank and CV down our throats during training, and so I think this is just business as usual, whether you're senior or whether you're one of the lower echelon sort of robot soldiers, you know.
Now, another thing that you've pointed out is that there is because this is a private company and because the Olympics is so heavily sponsored, that there's a real consciousness around the whole idea of brands and potential anyway for brand screening. That is to say that when G4S are letting people into the Olympics, they will be looking at what is on their T-shirt, whether it's an official sponsor of the Olympics or not. Do you think that that is actually going to happen?
I know for a fact that that's going to happen, because that's what we've been trained to do. Ian Horstman-Sewell, who's the MD of the Global Events, who's basically my boss, basically said the other day that there'll be no brand screening. Well, that completely contradicts the training that I've already had, where we were specifically told that if someone turned up in a T-shirt that was from a company who wasn't sponsoring the Games, then we had to tell them to take the T-shirt off, turn it the other way around, or go home and get changed, or basically leave the Games. If they entered the venues with a T-shirt turned the opposite way around, inside out in effect, and then turned it the right way around once they were in, the venue, they would then be asked to leave. In actual fact, they'd be kicked out. That's how serious they are about that. And they said, look, you know, companies have paid millions and millions and millions of pounds to sponsor the Olympics. The last thing that we want to do or be responsible for is letting people in with other brands who haven't paid a penny, getting their T-shirts on, you know, the front line as Usain Bolt wins the 100 metres or something, which apparently they said companies were aiming to do.
So do you think that that's actually serious, that there are companies out there that didn't sponsor the Olympics that decided instead said that they would send armies of members of the public in with their T-shirts on in order to get them on the TV?
Maybe. I mean, you know, G4S said that a certain drinks company who weren't sponsoring the Games were giving rewards away to people if they could get their T-shirt photographed by a member of the press at a significant moment, and the rewards apparently were quite substantial. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. But look, even if it is, it's fair game, isn't it, for those other companies to do that. You know, we shouldn't really be responsible here for telling members of the public, you know, to take their T-shirts off, get changed, turn the T-shirts inside out. You know, this is not for us, you know. It's not on. And even if those people have spent millions of pounds, those other companies, on sponsoring the Games, they've got their logos everywhere. They're on TV. They're going to be broadcast to billions of people around the world. You know, some kid who's, you know, 9 years old wearing a T-shirt of a food provider that's, again, not sponsoring the Games, you know, is going to be upset. It's going to ruin their day. People are going to be having getting changed in the PSA areas. This is ridiculous. This shouldn't be allowed to happen. And this is what G4S are advocating.
Okay, on a more serious note, you've also said that certain people who are called internationally protected people, there is going to be no screening whatever for them. So who are these so-called internationally protected people?
Internationally protected people are anybody who LOCOG say they are. They are not necessarily diplomats or anyone like prime ministers or presidents, even though they would be included, I'm sure. These people, that anyone that LOCOG says you're an internationally protected person, which means if somebody, they want to bring in somebody, you know, they just bring him in under the international protected person guise, and we cannot search them. And I think this is unfair. We should be searching everybody for the same reasons that the metal detectors should be turned on all the time. And, you know, this idea of switching them off at peak times is absolutely ridiculous.
So if there's a whole category of people who are coming in that know that they're not going to be searched, surely that they are potentially a bunch of people that may be, you know, possibly used by terrorists, or may even have terrorists have infiltrated that group. Do you know roughly how many people are come in that category?
No, I don't. But it's a fair few. What we were told, basically, by the trainers was that we would get the team leader, that is, would get a call to say that a certain someone's coming through your PSA, they cannot be searched. And so they would then, as soon as they arrived, we would let them straight through. You know, members of the public have to be searched. Everybody has to be searched, I think, if they stop the metal detector. They should all walk through the metal detector. Everything should be working. Everything should be switched on. The internationally protected people, whilst we can, you know, give them as much respect as possible, we'll do it very nicely and very politely, as we would with anybody, they still need to go through that very same process. I don't mind that they go through a VIP section that's quieter than, say, the general public's area. I'm not expecting that to happen, but they still need to go through that same process where their bags are x-rayed, where they walk through the metal detector, and if it sets off, they get searched. That's standard operating procedure for any nightclub, pretty much. Major nightclub in London. Why can't that be the case at the Olympics?
Well, I'm going to bring Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in now. Martin, you know, this is pretty worrying, isn't there? We've got a whole category of people called internationally protected, whatever that means, who cannot be screened and cannot be searched by the G4S staff. Isn't that sort of an open door if there's going to be some sort of inside operation going on?
No, I think the real open door is G4S itself. We know for a fact that in the past, terrorist actions, for example, the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which was carried out by the Italian security services, and that's been proved by an Italian parliamentary investigation. The Brabant massacres in the 1980s were carried out by the Western intelligence services. That's been proved by a Belgian investigation. The real danger with private security services, especially with lots of ex-military involved, is that they are the terrorists, never mind the internationally protected people.
None of them want to have some sort of terrorist. What would be the motive?
What would be the motive for the bombing of Bologna railway station? It's actually to create fear and terror. We know that this kind of false flag terrorism is a possibility. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but it's definitely a possibility, and it should be a number one priority of those in charge of the security to protect against
Bologna,
which is why G4S shouldn't be in charge. And what Lee was saying last week about how the police are being kept at arm's length, that's the thing that worries me the most, and perhaps Lee could comment on that.
Well, before he does, Bologna railway station bombing was back in 1980. Admittedly, it killed something like
86 people.
Around about 90 people. But that's a long time ago.
No, it's not. The point is that we've got a track record of people inside the Western intelligence services being the terrorists. Now, I could go on and on and on about this, because, as you know, this is the sort of topic which I know a lot about.
Well, point us towards one sort of area where we can find out about that, though?
I'll give you one word, Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O. People need to just look it up in their computer and they will see that there's a massive pile of evidence that Richard Cottrell, who's an ex-Conservative MEP, has just written a book all about it. The real threat of terrorism, Al-Qaeda included, is actually from within the Western Intelligence Services, which the Western Intelligence Services themselves admit they did create Al-Qaeda. They said it just turned into a Frankenstein's monster. I don't believe them.
Now, Lee, can I just pick up on one thing that Martin said there and ask you about it? And that is this whole idea of the what is essentially the G4S and the private security actually telling the police what to do.
Yeah, that's right. What's happening is this. G4S are wanting to be, and perhaps they're going to be, the police/security force of choice in the future. They are going to be running all policing operations in this country. They know this. They know that they're already taking over West Midlands Police. Okay, it's back room at the moment, but it's going to be frontline services pretty soon. There are a number of other police stations they're wanting to get hold of. They already run prisons. They already run detention centres. You know, they are going to be the police.
But how can you possibly say that? Sorry to interrupt you, Lee, but how can you possibly say that? There hasn't been any actual decision made by the people or the government that they are going to take over from the police. We've had an announcement from their, I believe it was either their chairman or chief executive week before last, that he believes that the police will be privatised within the next 5 years. But surely that's a decision for the government and through the people.
Yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? But this is how G4S acts. So the fact that they're treating the police quite badly and saying we've got more powers than them, we're untouchable, this is all just playing into the idea that people in G4S, obviously the higher echelons of the company and in our government, know what is to come, and G4S are being lined up as the security/police force of choice. That's why they've got the Olympic contract. That's why they've been allowed to go from 86 million to 284 million pound contract that the taxpayers are paying for. They know this, and this is why I think they're being flippant about the police and saying, well, you know, they're not going to have much to do during the Olympics. They're going to be bored and laughing about it and all that kind of stuff. They're pretty flippant in that way. And I think it's because eventually it's the slow creep. That's what it is. I mean, we already know that they want to investigate crimes, that they're wanting the forensic services as well. They already run asylum housing, which has gone very bad. In Australia, where they do prisoner transportation, they had an Aboriginal guy in the back of one of their vans, drove him across the desert, and they killed him. The heat inside the van killed the guy. And this is what's going to happen. There's a whole catalogue of G4S disasters all around the world, and that's what's going to come to this country. And I think that this is probably the most important issue that this country has. Who polices the people? Now, it's supposed to be by consent. If it's a private company, that will no longer be the case. And G4S are using the Olympics to basically as a staging post to say, hey, look how great we did at the Olympics, or not, which is why I'm such a problem for them at the moment, and this is what we could offer you as our other services and what have you, as we do this slow creep towards taking over every policing service in the country. And that's what I think.
Well, I'm a bit amazed to hear that the G4S originally with LOCOG agreed to do the security for £86 million. And how has that managed to creep? You're talking about creep. This is another kind, almost as bad. The apparently that contract has now got crept its way up to £284 million. How on earth has that happened?
Yeah, we don't have any definite answers. I mean, I can't actually find anything other than to say that at first, from what I can gather, that 86 million was to train 2,000 security officers. And then Locog came to them and said, look, you know, can you do, you know, a further 8.5 or whatever it is to 10,400? And they said, well, that's going to cost you 284 million. The trouble is, this is what's happening with the Olympics, is that a service that costs a dollar today, as soon as you slap a London Olympics logo on it, companies are charging $4, $5 pounds for that service, but still offering the £1, $1 service. And this is what's happened with G4S. Now, as far as, you know, they're earning 284 million, they still want more. I saw an interview with one of their chief executives. Again, it was this, it's actually the MD of Global Events, Ian Horsall Sewell. And he said that they want more. And it actually, they're acting like they're almost like the NHS or some public, some public sector company. They're not. They're a private company, and they just want to take more and more money and deliver less and less service. And and they must be stopped really at every cost.
Now, you talked last week about the evacuation of London, which is a pretty staggering concept in itself, you know, with something like 11.5-12 million people to get out of London. But how well have you been trained in just doing the sort of basic evacuation of one of the stadia or, you know, the Olympic Park itself?
Well, this is the irony of it all, is that we're told about the evacuation of London. We're told about this event that's going to take place after the Olympics. But what we're actually not told about is actually what a security officer needs to know. How do you evacuate the Olympic Stadium? I have no idea. I have no clue on that. We haven't even had a PowerPoint presentation and says, in theory, this is what you should do. Your team leader will direct you to do this. None of that has happened. We don't know how to evacuate the Olympic Park. Just basic health and safety hasn't been discussed. We're being told about all this kind of, you know, big stuff going on. But what actually we're not told about is all the small things, like maybe a first aid course. You know, we're not, you know, if someone collapses during the line waiting to come into the Olympics, and those queues are going to be vast, let's not kill ourselves about those. If someone has heat exhaustion and they collapse, the security staff are supposed to know what to do until, say, St. John's ambulance or a paramedic arrives. The security staff for G4S are just going to look at them. Now, God forbid that person in the line has a heart attack. Well, I know what to do because I've done emergency first-person first aid training, but Locog isn't paying for that, so G4S isn't doing it. So therefore, if you're having a heart attack on the floor, the G4S security officer is just going to look at you, you know, and that to me is scary.
Okay, now also we've seen over the last few weeks, basically back at the beginning of June, one of the police chiefs in Britain, this is the, I think he's the chief constable of Derbyshire, Mike Creedon, has said that there will be absolutely no privatisation on his watch in his area. He says privatisation is a dangerous precedent for the future of law enforcement. Mick Creedon said there was no evidence that privatisation was cheaper or better and cared too much about his staff to allow them to be transferred to the private sector. So, the argument from G4S is always, Lee, that they are cheaper and better. So, what would you have to say to that particular chief constable who stuck his neck out really there, saying, well, it's not happening on my watch?
Well, you know, he's going to be one of those people at the forefront of battling G4S. It's not going to be me. I'm one journalist. That's it. It's going to be people like him who have experience in the policing sector, who know what they're talking about, and he is being very brave. You know, I think what's going to happen is that people are going to side, you know, some chief constables will side with him, and you're going to get this sort of patterned effect across the country. We have maybe one or two areas that are G4S areas, and then you'll go back into sort of a British policing kind of area, and then you're back into another G4S area, and it's going to be confusion and mayhem. The one thing that G4S have got right is that they're certainly cheaper. We know that. Their metal detectors at the Olympics, Heaven Nightclub in London have got better metal detectors than they've got. But they're certainly not better. In fact, they're a lot worse. They don't know how to train their people. They cut corners on every level. And really, if we let them take it over any of the policing services, we're going to see those things start collapsing. Jimmy Magemba died in custody. He was an Angolan asylum seeker, and he died in G4S custody. And that actually led to G4S losing a major contract to look after asylum seekers. So, you know, this happens already in this country. We have proof already that G4S can't do the job that they are tasked to do. And really, you know, they should stick to being a small security company. But it's too late. They are the biggest company in the world outside of, I think it's Walmart is the biggest, and they're the second largest company. So really, in effect, we've lost the battle already. But it's going to be those police constables in London, in areas around the country, who have to stand up for themselves, and this is the time to do it. In a year's time, it will be too late. It may be too late already, but, you know, this is, however, if we all survive the Olympics.
Okay, finally, Lee, the question here, I suppose, is you say it's already happened, but surely there are some kind of proper checks and balances somewhere down the line that may lead to G4S's getting their comeuppance, as you would see it. That is to say, you know, that some of these failings may be pointed out. So can you just point us towards, you know, the sort of event or the sort of thing that you might see which may get the government and public money withdrawn from G4S?
Well, I mean, you know, if there's a disaster at the Olympics, I'm not talking about a false flag disaster. I'm talking about, you know, people fainting, complaints, things like that. You know, the smaller, sort of more personal things that's going to affect members of the public directly who are waiting in the queues and things like that. That will affect G4S. If people protest, you know, go to the internet, look up G4S, see all the disasters they're involved in, write to your MP. You know, we need to all kind of mobilise now. And, you know, for far too long, really, we've been kind of, we're asleep in this country, I think.
But Lee, hang on a second, because, I mean, there are all sorts of problems with the existing police. You know, there are lots of deaths in custody that aren't properly investigated, for example.
Sure, but they are accountable. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we can stand there and say, hold on, we've got to have this investigated. And I know it's not perfect. It really isn't. And we've had a lot of problems with the police, as we all know. But they are accountable. You know, we can force things. It might take years. It might take years with the police as it is. But they are accountable to the members of the public and to Parliament. This is going to be a private company. If you think the police have made mistakes, think about what a private company is going to be like. And, you know, they are not accountable to anybody other than their shareholders. So it's now that we have to act. Otherwise, it's going to be too late.
OK, Lee, thanks ever so much for speaking to us again. We hope to have another chat next week.
Thank you very much. I'll speak to you soon.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, I'm joined now by Paul Gain from Remploy here in Bristol. Hi, Paul, and welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, hello, Tony.
Now, Remploy, can you just tell us a bit about it? What is Remploy?
Remploy is basically a company that employs disabled people that may not be able to get mainstream employment. It was developed in the mid-40s after the war. So servicemen who got injured in the war come back, get some training, and maybe go on to further employment. So it's been run a very, very long time, and unfortunately the funding is going to be pulled out, so we're going to lose our jobs, basically.
But yeah, as I understand it, I mean, we did a report on you 3 or 4 weeks ago on what's happening, and you tell me that there is going to be at least an attempt for you to keep your jobs. How, what are you planning?
Basically, the unions are proposing industrial action to try and get our point across. So,
yeah, what sort of industrial action, though? Because in a way, it's one of those weird situations where if you actually withhold your labour or go on strike or whatever, you're kind of almost biting off the hand that's feeding you. You're making sure that Remploy itself isn't making so much money. It's almost like you're boosting the case to get rid of you.
No, not really, because the industrial action may only be to work to rule, to make sure you're there on time, etc. No overtime, maybe an overtime ban. There may not be actual strike action to start off with. It depends if it goes down that road.
Okay, I'm also joined by Mark Cambridge. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Tony.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what is your disability?
I have spina bifida and hydrocephalus, and I've been with Remploy since the, March 1987, working as a factory operative and also working in the administration department on a part-time basis.
Okay, and what did you think when you first heard that there were threats to Remploy by this present coalition government?
Like the rest of my colleagues, I was very, very angry, very disappointed. We're all very concerned about our futures and our future direction.
Okay, and what do you think is your view about any kind of attempt to keep your jobs? How? I mean, surely at the end of the day, if there isn't the money for you, then that's it. You're just going to have to lose them.
Not necessarily. I think the whole issue relating to Remploy needs to be looked at in a far more broad-minded manner. I would like to see all parties involved brought much closer together to talk to each other, to listen to each other, work with each other to try and overcome the problems that we have. I don't think it's just a case of someone getting up on Monday morning and making a decision and saying we should be closed. I don't think it's as simple as that. It's a very complex issue. You're dealing with a wide range of people with a wide range of problems. And I don't think it's as straightforward as just saying, right, let's close it.
Now, one of the things that that was told to me, this is 3 weeks ago when I was down at Remploy, around our up back of Old Market, was that actually the Bristol office, the Bristol factory, I suppose you could call it, it's a big industrial unit, isn't it, was actually making money, which I find unbelievable. Surely they can't close down a money-making exercise.
No, well, the Bristol factory is doing exceptionally well. We're fully loaded. We have been for the best part of the last 2 years. We've got lots of work on for the foreseeable future, which further, I feel, backs up our argument to keep us open. I think it's critical for us and also for future generations.
Can you not just simply then sort of set up your own your own business or your own cooperative? You just simply take that work on and say, in a way, stick two fingers up at the Remploy management and the government and say, well, we're going to go it alone.
That may be possible, but you have to look at the issue very seriously indeed, because of overhead costs. Taking into account our existing site, we have very, very high overhead costs there. We would have to look at relocating to a more suitable site.
Well, what would a more suitable site look like? Well,
much smaller.
Yeah.
Much,
so are you saying that you're not actually using all the warehouse space that you've got over in Old Market?
Not necessarily, no. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that, you know, basic costs like electricity, heating, you know, all those sort of issues are very expensive, like they are with people in their homes, and they have to be taken into account. All issues have. If we're going to have a workers' cooperative, it has to be looked at in a very serious manner, and we have to bring people together and look at the issue very, very carefully indeed.
So, Paul, if I can bring you in again, how is this affecting your existing contractors? Because obviously there are people who want Remploy to do the work. They will now be scratching their heads and thinking, well, maybe we should be looking elsewhere. That's not actually helping your present situation, is it?
It's strange enough, we're getting more work in. They're sending more work into the site, which you think any sane person would think, hang on a minute, this... But now we're getting more work into the site. So, it's like, as Mark said, we've got plenty of work.
Okay, can you just tell us what kind of work you do? You know, maybe we can get some more work for you.
Well, what we do scanning, we do indexing and prepping for various companies like Honeywell and the NHS. We do a very important job because we convert paper records into much more environmentally friendly formats so that people can gather information far quicker and far more effectively, which saves time and money.
Okay, now, so Paul, can you just tell us a little bit about your trade union and you know, how you've been working with them and what they've done so far?
Basically, trade unions have... they've been meeting with the government and the management to discuss what the situation of Remploy, and hopefully soon we will be told one way or the other what's going to happen.
Have they made any decision about keeping some of the places which are actually making money? Because, I mean, even the most cruel conservative surely can't want to close down a factory which is actually turning a profit.
There's two phases of what we've been told. There's two phases of merging factories with other businesses which to take us on. And this is phase one, which is, I can't remember how many factories now actually going, but the next phase two is about 11, 12 factories, which then hopefully they get other people to take us on.
All right. Have they been particularly helpful then, your trade union? Have you got sort of a union rep in your place?
Yes, we have.
Yes. And are they actually discussing the future of Remploy with who? Is it at the government? Who are the sort of main Remploy people? That are actually making these decisions. This is what we want to know, is who is deciding that this place which is making money and employing disabled people has to go?
It's the government and the head management with the trade unions. The trade unions are trying to keep our jobs, or if we do get took over by another business, get the best deal as we can.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here again. Martin, this one does get me banging my head against the wall, actually, or throwing things around the studio, because it does seem to make little sense, particularly when, for many of the people at Remploy, it's simply going to be, onto benefits, this kind of thing. So why on earth and how on earth have we come to this?
Well, it's just ideology, isn't it? I mean, Remploy has functioned very successfully for decades. It's a functioning, worthwhile organisation. And yes, maybe it is some of the sites subsidised a bit by the government. But the alternative, as you've just pointed out, Tony, if you close these sites, is to put these people onto benefits. And these places are actually designed for disabled people. The way the government is trying to finesse it is say, oh, we don't want to ghettoise disabled people. We want them to work in the rest of industry, and we're going to make the rest of industry, friendly to disabled people. And this is a progressive move. So we're not going to have this. It's like the whole argument that used to be about special schools, and that we're going to get the kids out of special schools and we're going to put them into the ordinary schools. Now, of course, I'm all in favour of integration between disabled and non-disabled people, but let's face it, that's not always feasible and it's not always going to work. And in actual fact, what we've got here is a perfectly well-functioning setup, and basically I just see it as industrial vandalism, especially when you're closing places which are making a profit and drawing it. You know what you're doing is you're undermining the competition, aren't you? That's the problem. Somebody else thinks they can make more money out of it, because what you're doing as a government run organisation is that your profits, if you like, go back to the society as a whole, and that's obviously not acceptable to some people.
So you talk about this being an ideological decision. What kind of ideology is it that says that disabled people should be treated like this?
Well, I think it's when they try to push it as a progressive thing, as I say, they're saying that we don't want disabled people all in one place doing one thing. We want them out in industry working with everybody else. Now, in an ideal world, that might be a good idea, but there isn't actually any work out there in mainstream industry for able-bodied people, as we know. So what's basically happens is that something that's worked very well, and presumably the relationships in Remploy are really good, they sound really good between the local managers and the workers and the unions and so on, an example to others about how to do it, basically. And they're just not interested in that. They just, don't forget, governments love to change things, because otherwise what are governments for? They're there to change things, aren't they? That's the thing. Well, we've got to change things, we've got to think radically.
Well, I suppose my question is, who benefits? Cui bono?
Well, ultimately, breaking down this kind of welfare stroke industrial institution is about atomizing ordinary people, stopping them having places where they can come together to defend their interests and so on. You've got trade unions in Remploy for obvious reasons, but many people in industry have no trade union representation anymore, and they haven't had it for many years. And you're an anomaly these days having a proper trade union representation. Let's get rid of that. That's the attitude.
Well, Paul, the attitude Martin just expressed there is totally contrary to what we're doing here. Can you just tell us how people can help support what you're doing at Remploy? Because I think the vast majority of civilised human beings out there will want to think that Bristol Remploy will succeed in staying open and actually go on to greater things in the future.
Basically, petition the government. We've had apart from your good self, we've had a lot of good feedback from the Sunday Express, which they put many good articles in their paper about what the work we do. So we just got to pressurise the government and say, look, come on, think.
I think they may be made to back off on this, because it's the sort of issue that ordinary people may decide that they're going to take a stand on, because it's not necessarily in their personal interests. It's about what kind of society we want to live in. Yeah.
There's an interesting aspect to this, and that is that one of the main problems with Remploy as a profit-making business is the sort of apex of the structure, the sort of top of the pyramid, which is their head office. And a lot of the people who are actually running the organisation are actually able-bodied.
Well, indeed. I mean, these lads will know better than I do what that sort of problem is. I mean, maybe you have got, if you like, you know, traitors at the top who are not actually defending your interests as well as they might, but you will know better than I.
Can I ask you then, Paul, do you have confidence in the head office of Remploy? Do you think that they are looking after the interests of the employees that they are supposed to be serving?
On some issues, yes. No, there's other issues, no. It's basically like that. They are good on certain issues, but when it comes to minor things, no. But this one's a big one, and they are. I'll put my hands up to the manager, but they are fighting because it's not. Because they know, the management do know, a lot of us will not work again. Mm-hmm. A lot of us will be on benefits, and we don't want to be on benefits. We are disabled. We are working, we are paying tax, which the government will lose if we're unemployed and we'd be on benefit. So, all right, they may save money in one hand, but then they got to push out in the other. So I can't see the logic.
Now, there is a consultation going on at the moment, which is one of those horrible things. It's almost like waiting between doing your exam and getting your results, where you're sort of biting your nails, not quite sure what they're going to say. Am I right in thinking that that's due to be announced very soon, what the results of that is?
We've been informed it's maybe put back until mid-July. And then a decision may be made, but as you know, the government go on their summer holiday, so we don't know. Hopefully we'll be told something more concrete mid-July, but personally I'm not holding my breath.
So Martin, do you think there's been a deliberate attempt here then, just sort of kick this one out because it's a little bit of a difficult, thorny issue?
I think this is the sort of thing in which the government could be made to turn round if there's enough public pressure. And I don't think it's a party political thing. I think people across the political spectrum would see Remploy as a good organisation and worth supporting. And I think you should take heart, go out to the community, explain your case, and put the pressure on the government, because I think they're looking weaker by the day. Don't forget, they're not looking as if they're too competent, and they need to actually pull a few chestnuts out of the fire. And rescuing Remploy could be it could be something good for them. Wow, we're not so bad after all. Look at us, people.
Okay, now finally then, what is your trade union then, Paul? And how can people sort of keep track of what's going on and support you other than just writing to the MP? Have you got, are you on Facebook or anything, this kind of thing?
It's the GMB. And we've also got Unite in the Bristol site as well. So go to their websites and just follow the links. The last time we looked, there was something for putting in petitions. So just do that and help us out, please.
Okay, so the two unions involved are Unite and the GMB. Well, Paul Gain and your friend, I can't remember, what's your friend's name again?
Mark Cambridge,
thanks ever so much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, a little look at world affairs. Martin, we've had some big bombs, haven't we, in Syria this week. One, I think it was Wednesday on the TV station, the Syrian television station, and then
it was an attack by armed,
the place was blown to pieces.
Yeah.
An attack by armed people, and then basically a battle going on in the Syrian television station.
It wasn't much of a battle because it was all one-sided, but yes, go on.
And then bombs and a battle at just outside the Justice Ministry.
Yes, and also this Turkish plane that was shot down in Syrian airspace.
That was just about a week ago. It was just happened when we were on air last Friday.
Yeah.
So how do you see this all panning out now?
Well, the Western powers are meeting in, I think it's in Geneva, next week to discuss moves to remove the current regime. The Iranians haven't been invited to the meeting. They're sidelining the UN. They want no more of this UN peace process and attempts to negotiate. They want to try and remove the regime.
Well, this whole thing was discussed, in fact, just yesterday on the BBC. Mark Mallock Brown is a former Deputy Director General of the United Nations and a former Labour MP or MEP. I'm not quite sure which. But anyway, let's have a little listen to what they were saying. About it on the BBC, and he was also talking alongside David Mellor too.
Fact is, Qatar and Saudi Arabia evidently already are arming the rebels, which is why they're putting up a much better fight of it now than they were a month or two ago. So, you know, I think we're into, it's a minute to midnight, there's a last chance for diplomacy. If it doesn't work, then I fear it's going to be a fully fledged
conflict. I agree with Mark. I know we're not, probably not on here to agree with each other, but I do
agree
with you.
It's all right, it's allowed.
Good. And I think that Kofi Annan has called this meeting in Geneva, isn't it?
Yes.
And that is a last ditch. But otherwise, I mean, I do think that serious efforts have got to be made to try and persuade the Russians to take a more constructive view. I also think that, of course, I mean, experienced people in the region have been telling me, like my old friend Abdullah Bashara, who was the founding General Secretary of the Gulf Cooperation Council, former President of the Security Council. He said to me, oh, don't worry, Bashar al-Assad will be gone by Christmas.
So, Martin, the Gulf Cooperation Council, who are they?
Well, they represent the Saudi, the various Persian Gulf autocracies who never have any elections of any serious kind anyway.
You mean dictatorships?
Yes, those dictatorships. And what I would say to them, if Assad goes, then I would call for an armed uprising against these dictatorships in the Gulf, because, of course, the British will support you with arms, and also the RAF, as we did in Libya. They'll come and bomb the Saudis for you. I mean, the lesson is very clear. Peaceful protest doesn't work. The only way to get rid of a regime in the Middle East is to take a gun in your hand and start killing soldiers and civilians, whoever gets in the way. It doesn't have to. And you know, war's not a terrible thing. It has to happen sometimes. So let's have a war in Saudi Arabia.
But Martin,
and let's fight those government that fight the Saudi monarchy out of power, whatever it costs, whatever it takes, however much blood has to be spilled.
But surely
they've got to go.
The British government aren't actually saying that, are they?
No, they're not. That shows how the inconsistency of their position. So in Syria, the government's got to go, and if they don't go, I mean, it's quite clear, the Hula massacre, I mean, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the German Daily Telegraph, is suggesting that was carried out by the rebels rather than by the government, but it's quite clear, an attack on a TV station that kills 7 journalists has been condemned by journalists all over the world. What is it if, how would it be if, because people didn't like what we were saying on this TV show, we were regarded as a propaganda arm of somebody or other, and they came in and shot us all, which is exactly what happened this week in Syria. And the British government are supporting these people as freedom fighters. Now, I accept that there are freedom fighters in the world, like in Nicaragua there were freedom fighters, maybe in Ireland there were freedom fighters, maybe all over the world there are freedom fighters, but don't use two standards. If it's all right to take up arms against the regime of Assad, it's all right to take up arms against the State of Israel, where it's occupying against the wishes of the people, it's all right to take up arms against the government of Saudi Arabia and their allies, of course. If you are a Saudi patriot, you don't just go out to fight your own government, you're out to fight your own government's enemies, and that includes the British people. Not the British people, the British government. Of course, if we're going to go down this road, that armed rebellion is justified, then that's how it's going to be.
But isn't it really the fact is that surely armed rebellions are only justified when the leader has not got the favour of NATO, Israel and the West?
Well, it looks like it, because Assad held an election, which the West poo-pooed a few weeks ago, but 60% of the population participated in it, and you can't really argue with that, except although we are trying to argue with it. What the Russians are pushing for is, why don't we get some of the people in the rebel side, some of the people in the government together, and get some kind of power sharing sorted out. And as we saw this week, Martin McGuinness shook the hand of the Queen. These things are possible, but of course, if it's a winner take all game, it's winner take all. Brits out, innit?
Okay, now what about Libya? Because in Libya we've heard recently that the International Criminal Court sent a delegation in there with some documents calling for the arrest and turning over of Saif Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi's son, and they were actually arrested within Libya. And there's also problems at the airport. There was a faction of rebels that took over the airport. So how's things going in Libya?
Libya is turning into another Iraq, which, as we all know, is a very happy country now, having been invaded. Incidentally, the democratically elected government of Iraq and the democratically elected government of Lebanon both both support the Assad regime, which we're not really being told by BBC, are we? Because in actual fact, the idea that all of our enemies have got no popular support and our friends have got most popular support is an illusion, a delusion. Civil wars are civil wars. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia. Everybody was in the wrong. Everybody was killing everybody else. What a great happiness we've brought upon these people with our interventions.
Well, a lawyer is to be held, we hear today, in Libya for some time. Despite constructive negotiations over jailed Australian lawyer Melinda Taylor, Libya appears to be convinced of her guilt as a conduit for secret communications between Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam Gaddafi and hunted members of the former regime. So there are more people being arrested who are going in there.
Well, incidentally, in relation to Libya, people should look up Southern Mistral 2011, which was supposedly a war game between the French and British air forces, which was basically a rerun or a pre-run of exactly what happened in Libya. So we are being told by our government here that these various events took place in Libya, and as a result of pressure on the ground and because the situation was out of hand, we had to intervene. But it's quite clear that the RAF and the French Air Force had planned for a no-fly zone at least a year before what happened.
Which means, in other words, the whole thing's being orchestrated. Martin, their job as armed forces to prepare for potential incidents in the future.
Well, indeed, it's also been suggested in things I've been seeing on the internet, the British Special Forces are already inside Syria. Now, that may well be true or may not be true. It may be G4S that's inside Syria. But the fact of the matter is, from the Syrian government's point of view, they are enemies of the state to be eliminated. Of course, if you can beat them, that's fine. But the Syrian army is not going to be easy to beat. It's going to be a proper fight. And the Russians and the Chinese can't be counted on to stand back from it either.
Now, there's also talk by Hillary Clinton and others that maybe the... In fact, on that clip we just heard from the BBC there, that maybe the Security Council has kind of lost its mettle because they're not calling for the intervention in Syria that they should be.
Well, that's because the Russians and the Chinese, who between them represent about half humanity, don't agree with what's going on. They know, and the rest of the world knows, if you read the rest of the world's press, that the rebels inside Syria are being supported and trained by Western intelligence services, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, by the Turkish special forces, who actually killed 30,000 people in Kurdistan in the 1980s. But nobody talks about that. Perhaps we should invade Turkey and free Kurdistan. Oh, hang on a minute. Perhaps we should invade China and free Tibet. No, hang on. That's something. Oh, no, hang on a minute. It's only Syria that's like singled out for this, because it's part of a geopolitical game to take down the Iranians.
But what about...
Because the Iranians are supposedly have nuclear weapons, which nobody believes they've got or have any intention of getting. This is warmongering, pure and simple. And it's the people of Syria, of all political beliefs, who are paying the price. Many people who are opposed to Assad voted in his election because they don't want these rebels in charge. They are Wahhabi terrorists supported by the Saudis, Al-Qaeda-linked, many of them. But of course, Al-Qaeda-linked doesn't mean anti-Western. The Western intelligence services have been working with these people all the way. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is Al-Qaeda Libya, and they've been working with the Western intelligence services since the 1980s. And people need to wake up what Islamist terrorism is. It's a manipulation by Western intelligence services for geopolitical purposes.
But hang on a minute. Last Friday, a Turkish jet, a NATO jet, was shot down by the Libyans. Surely that's...
Not the Libyans, the Syrians.
Sorry, by the Syrians. That's an act of war, isn't it?
It was in their territorial waters. They know for a fact that the Turks are allowing Syrian rebels to infiltrate over the borders. I sent you a very interesting article, if you saw last week, by the second in command of the Lebanese army, pointing out that all of the fighting going on inside Syria is happening near the borders because through infiltrators coming over the borders. A bit like sort of people crossing the border in Northern Ireland, yeah? Or crossing the border in Bosnia, or crossing the border from Namibia into South Africa.
Well, that doesn't sound like the Free Syrian Army doing that.
Well, what is the Free Syrian Army? It's just a name, isn't it? What we've got here is a series of groups, all of which are being manipulated by outside forces. The idea that this is some kind of popular uprising led from inside the country is absurd.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Time to go back now to Somerset businessman Julian Parry. Now, Julian, you brought a great picture from one of the newspapers in Somerset showing your bill that you got, your utility bill. You just decided to swap over, didn't you, from one energy company to another. Can you just tell us about that?
Yes. Well, you know, we got the call from E.ON, that great supplier of energy, both electrical and gaseous, and I decided upon the spur of the moment, as you do, to leave EDF and British Gas and take up E.ON's offer. Well, I thought we were going to be on a direct debit, but for some reason they had trouble putting that together. So suddenly I got a bill from them, which was quite a shock in itself, and the bill said that I owed them £2,901.09. Don't let's forget the 9 pence. And allegedly...
Sorry, can you say the figure again?
£2,901.09. Don't let's forget the pennies. Anyway, the fact of the matter is that this represents a consumption of somewhere over 25, 26 megawatts in a month. If I had consumed that amount of energy in the building in a month, I would have burned the place to the ground. So it's obviously a human error. In actual fact, bless them, E.ON have admitted it and have said that the data was false.
So they just put their decimal point in the wrong place then, did they?
Well,
this is a bit annoying, isn't it, if it's a direct debit? Can you just give us an idea? I mean, is that the amount of money that's actually been taken out of your bank account?
No.
You have to flag it up, don't you?
Let me just develop the whole thing, because of course it's a bad one in a week. Where we've had RBS do the same thing, haven't we? In RBS's case, they blamed an assistant in India for pushing a button and wiping out all the data. It shouldn't happen. I'm going to say, my point with E.ON is not that some poor assistant made a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. The point I'm making is that their computer systems should have been robust enough to spot the mistake, flag it up, and make sure it never came out.
Martin, isn't it funny how when these computer systems kick in, they always make a mistake which seems to be almost in favour of the business rather than in favour of the customer?
Well, the point I made last week is these may be technical errors, but if there is a banking crash, as we were talking about earlier, Julian, people will find that it plays out for them exactly like this, that they won't be able to get their money. It's what happened in Argentina during the Corralito. The middle class simply lost its money.
What lessons have we got to learn from that then? That sounds pretty scary. This is in about 2000.
The point is that those who are in favour of super free market capitalism have got to remember that the super free market capitalist system depends upon periodic wipeouts where everybody loses everything, everything goes back to zero like a darts game. Now, if you're happy to live with that, fine. Otherwise, we need a managed system.
And here's another point to think in terms of the darts game. Let's face it, the game of Monopoly is supposed to be the game of life, where in the end, the banker wins everything. The point is that the bankers need to remember is that when they close the board on all the players who lost, they also close the board on the banker. And sometimes they forget that.
Game over.
That's why we have to go to new game, new reset, and everybody collects another £200. And that's where I think our society is going generally. But back to the functionality of the banks. We've had the RBS crash. We've had this E.ON thing where my complaint is not that somebody made a mistake, but that the computer systems weren't there. It isn't as though they can't afford it. E.ON are charging 3 times the generating cost is what actually appears on your bill when you know what the generating costs are. So it's not as though there isn't enough money. I've had another problem with a major mobile company. I got an iPhone, a very nice iPhone, absolutely wonderful piece of kit. But the company that was the mobile service took it on at £36 a month and was then charging £50 a month and charging me for things that actually didn't happen. So I've repudiated the contract, and no doubt we'll have a court case about it, and that's fine. I don't mind going to court. It's good sport.
Martin, ultimately, particularly in this new world of privatised utilities and the direct debit culture where you get to pay less, supposedly, if you sign up to a direct debit, what hope is there for the consumer in that kind of marketplace?
Well, the idea that competition always reduces prices is absurd. In certain kinds of markets, I mean, this is all in the economics textbooks at a fairly basic level. In certain kinds of markets, competition works, and that's in perfect markets, which never exist, or even in imperfect markets. But many markets are oligopolistic markets, which are run by a small number of inside players. There's no real competition. How many politicians have we had on this show who think that if you've got more than one firm in an industry, you've got competition? Economics textbooks do not suggest so. You can go up to quite large numbers of firms in an industry and they will be collaborative, they will cartelise, they will actually use confusion marketing. What does the little old lady do when there are 120 different firms trying to offer them a different price for something? She just goes for the one with the guy with the nicest face who looks nice.
They've got us by the short and curlies, basically.
Indeed,
this inability to compare one type of product with another. What can we actually do? Come on, I'm going to give you the final word on this.
What you need to do is when you go to the electricity industry, it's one structure, one board, one lot of people running it, and if there's anything wrong, somebody at the top shouts and everything's sorted out. There is actually a case for a hierarchically run, properly run man's army way of doing it, and that's the best way to run lots of infrastructure. And people don't want to be on a committee to run it, they just want it to work.
And the other thing is that we've had a big problem with Royal Mail. A friend of mine just had £35,000 taken out of his account because of a confusion over bills. And they said, oh, you can have a credit note. You can have the cash back in 10 days. Then they said, oh, no, you can't. You can only have a credit note. Oh, and by the way, here's the credit note, but you're going to have to sort a VAT out yourself because we've already paid it. Well, that's unlawful for a start. And this brings me very quickly to the direct debit indemnity scheme that everybody should know about. If you've got a problem with a direct debit problem on your account, go to your bank, tell them you've got it. They will put the money back the same day, and then they will take the problem up with the sponsor bank. Direct debit indemnity scheme.
Sounds like a great idea, and preferably don't let anyone have a direct debit with any of your accounts. That's because then that just gives them the right to put the finger in your account, doesn't it? And to take money out whenever they want to. Much, much better, I would say, just send a cheque to pay it at the end of the month. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Somerset businessman you just heard there as well, Julian Parry. Thanks also to the Bristol Remploy people. And also next week, we're not quite sure what's going to be happening next week. Certainly we're going to hear again from Lee Hazeldean. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear us at www.thisweek.org.uk. Music this week is from 1993 and Sybil.